This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. My name is Zifeng Liu, and I am a doctoral candidate in the Africana Studies and Research Center at Cornell University.
And I am Kelvin Ng, a doctoral student in history at Yale University.
Today, we are very honored to be joined by Professor Patricia Owens and Dr. Katarina Riesler. Patricia Owens is Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford. Her most recent book, Economy of Force, published by Cambridge University Press, won, among others, the 2016 Susan Strange Prize for the Best Book in International Studies and the 2016 International Studies Association Theory Section Best Book Award. Owens's first book was Between War and Politics, International Relations and the Thought of Hannah Arendt, published by Oxford University in 2007. Dr. Katarina Riesler teaches American, Women's, and International History at the University of Sussex, UK. Her work has appeared in journals such as Modern Intellectual History, the Journal of Global History, Diplomatic History, Diplomacy and Statecraft, Global Society, and in several edited collections. Riesler's main interest is in the history of international thought and internationalism in its social, political, economic, and legal dimensions from the 1910s to the 1960s. She is currently completing a book on 20th century US philanthropy, international thought, and the problem of the public.
Today, we will be discussing the new edited collection, Women's International Thoughts, A New History, recently published by Cambridge University Press. This book is the first cross-disciplinary history of women's international thought, bringing together some of the foremost historians and scholars of international relations working today. This book recovers and analyzes the path-breaking work of 18 leading thinkers of international politics from the early to mid-20th century. Recovering and analyzing this important work, the essays offer revisionist accounts of IR's intellectual and disciplinary history and expand the locations, genres, and practices of international thinking. Systematically structured and focusing in particular on Black diasporic, Anglo-American, and European historical women, it does more than, quote, add women to the existing intellectual and disciplinary histories from which they were erased, Instead, it raises fundamental questions about which kinds of subjects and what kind of thinking constitutes international thought, opening new vistas to scholars and students of international history and theory, intellectual history, and women's and gender studies.
Patricia and Katerina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us. It's a real honor.
Thank you, and many congratulations on the new book. So let's get right to the book. What was the theoretical or historiographical impetus behind this volume? This book recovers and analyzes the path-breaking work of 18 leading thinkers of international politics from the early to mid 20th century. In doing so, it raises fundamental questions about which kinds of subjects and what kind of thinking constitutes international thought. What are some of these constitutive exclusions that have structured the disciplines of international thought and intellectual history? And what have these disciplines occluded from view? Why were and are women's contributions to international thought neglected?
Well, the historiographical impetus behind the volume, well, there are many, but one is the near total exclusion of women in IR's intellectual and disciplinary history. So if I just speak about IR, I did a simple quantitative study of 60 histories just to get a sense of the scale of the problem. Fewer than 3% of references to historical figures were to historical women, those working before the late 20th century. And so, you know, we thought based on studies in similar fields like sociology and history that it was extremely unlikely that this was anything close to an accurate reflection of the breadth and depth of women's international thinking. And we understand international thinking to mean deep reflection on the relations between peoples, empires, and states. Some of the constitutive exclusions that have structured international relations as it emerged as a separate field, I mean, these have been studied by feminists, post-colonial scholars, and others for a long time. They center on gender, sexuality, race, empire, class, and nation. I think in this volume, we add genre and audience. You know, IR's canon has privileged, you know, major treaties as the genre for theoretical work on international relations. Women also wrote, you know, large major treaties, but also this work marginalizes genres in which women and many men worked, including in writing intended for more popular audiences.
Yeah, I think it's also important to emphasize, and coming here from the history side, this project is a real sort of conversation across the disciplines. And obviously, there has been so much important work in historical IR, which historians have obviously read and reflected on. But for me personally, coming from the history side of things, I had been researching the disciplinary history of international relations for almost a decade when I came to this project. And so just from the empirical record, it was very clear to me that there were many women who thought about, researched, and published on international affairs, and that really contrasted with their treatment in the literature. I mean, occasionally you would find hints, but there wasn't really anything like a systematic treatment of women who were international thinkers in a broader sense. The other thing that I think was quite obvious to international historians or intellectual historians of the international was that women were present at key locations for the production of international thought, whether that was conferences, academe, think tanks, philanthropic foundations, international organizations, and NGOs. So there was simply also a mismatch between the empirical evidence and the scholarly analysis of women and gender in international thinking. And I think the other thing that the volume does, besides the really important contributions that Patricia has just mentioned, is to use looking for women in international thought as a heuristic device, and probably also without the predetermined assumption that if you use that lens of women, you would uncover a genealogy of feminist international relations, because quite possibly you wouldn't. So this project really started then as a conversation across the disciplines. We had an initial kind of exchange in 2015, and it developed from there.
in terms of why women were marginalized in histories of international thought, particularly in the IR field, when, you know, as Katrina says, you know, they were so active and present in the interwar period, work we're still doing, but it seems to be partly the style of women's international thinking, which didn't fit during the creation of a new disciplinary canon for international relations in the 1950s in the United States. So during the 20s, 30s, 40s, and after, you know, IR women, certainly in the academy, you know, they practiced international relations thinking as economic and diplomatic historians. They were area specialists and comparativists, among other things. And so few of them seem to have been very interested in disciplinary boundary work that accelerated in the 1950s. They didn't particularly develop abstract theories of the international system in the effort to carve out distinct identity for IR as separate from what behaviorists and historians were doing. This is not to say that early IR women in the academy didn't engage in conceptual and theoretical work. Obviously they did, but they did not instigate or really participate in, you know, the grand theory wars between paradigms, which became one of the dominant modes of IR scholarship after World War II. You know, so they didn't join the men in the 50s inventing a canon of intellectual greats for IR and then seek to position themselves as its true heirs.
Thank you so much for that. And it's really interesting because this volume was born of the interdisciplinary research project, Women and the History of International Thought. So before we delve a bit deeper into the book, I just want to ask how the idea behind this volume developed. What was the editorial process like, and who were your interlocutors? And how did your own thinking around women's international thought evolve in process? So perhaps if you could just tell us a bit more about the larger research project. I know you also have been working on an exhibition as well.
Yeah. Katerina is too modest in her last answer. So Katerina and historians Velasco Huber and Tamsin Peach, they organized a workshop in 2015. And really there, the idea for the volume came. I mean, I was lucky enough to be invited to attend as the author of my first book on Hannah Arendt, which is the only monograph on an historical woman thinker, women's international thought in IR. I thought it would be good to broaden the conversation and had access to some money through the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. So Katrina and I organized, then we were both based at Sussex, organized a two-day exploratory seminar co-sponsored by intellectual historian David Armitage. So most of the contributors to the edited volume first presented their essays at this Radcliffe seminar. And our thinking was certainly shaped in this process, for me at least, and perhaps, I don't think this is less so for Katerina, but for me at least, it became very clear that the most interesting existing work on women's intellectual history the histories of women's international thought was in Black women's intellectual history. And it is only possible to say that histories of international thought have ignored women if we construct a disciplinary and ultimately racialized boundary between sort of histories of international thought and Black women's intellectual history. The larger Leverhulme research project on women and the history of international thought came out of the collaboration on this volume, and we realized that a collaborative funded project was really necessary to begin to sort of bring together existing forays, but to scratch the surface of what needs to be done in terms of recovery. I mean, here we're not certainly not the first to observe women's absence in intellectual and disciplinary history and also their presence. I mean, we strongly credit the work of Glenda Sluger and others for, you know, this work. We, in our project, wanted to broaden out to political theorists. We invited Kim Hutchings, who had worked on feminist theory and canonical figures. And the three of us worked together, joined for 2 years by postdoctoral researcher Sarah Dunstan and doctoral researcher Joe Wood. Do you want to talk about the conference? Exhibition?
Maybe just about the various outputs, because I think now you are being maybe a bit modest, because we have been very busy producing a number of journal articles, but also we are in the process of publishing an anthology of women's international thought. So that is a companion volume to the volume that is under discussion today. There have been several articles on the canon, on women and the canon. And we have also, or rather Sarah Dunstan, the postdoctoral researcher on the project, has produced, I think, a terrific oral history resource of women who are working in the field now, sort of senior women IR scholars. which is available on the project website. There is a blog that is updated monthly, and we will have an exhibition next year at the London School of Economics, which is currently in planning, or we are very much looking forward to that. And there will also be a conference. So, and I can only agree with Patricia. It has been a project that has only been possible by drawing on the really excellent and foundational work of many, many scholars. Black women's intellectual history has certainly been very important in that, and especially the foundational volume really edited by Barbara Savage, Martha Jones, and others toward an intellectual history of Black women that has been very important, but also research that is more at the kind of intersection of women's intellectual history and the history of women in diplomacy. And Glenda Sluger has already been mentioned, but Helen McCarthy would be another scholar who has been influential to us. But I could go on and on. There are many, many scholars whose excellent work we have been fortunate to draw into the project, not just in this edited volume, but also in the other outputs that we are still producing. Sorry, that sounds terribly managerial output, but it is grant language, but if you excuse that, apologies.
Oh no, thank you so much for really introducing to us all those important projects that you have completed and that you are still working on. You know, like I would like to you to talk more about your interlocutors. So the title of the introduction of this volume, Toward a History of Women in International Thought, reminds me, as someone who is working on a dissertation about Black women's internationalism, of two other groundbreaking collections in women's intellectual history. So Katarina just mentioned one of them. There are two that I can think of. One is Toward an Intellectual History of Women. The other one is Toward an Intellectual History of Black Women. And then there are other volumes about women's internationalism, and there are scholars who are also doing that kind of work. So I would like to ask about this practice of women's anthologies. Could you say a little bit about anthologies as a feminist genre? And more specifically, what insights can we gain when we put the women intellectuals that you and other contributors study into conversation?
Yeah, the title of the introduction was an homage to these earlier groundbreaking volumes. We were really lucky to have Linda Kerber and Barbara Savage at the Radcliffe Seminar. As Katrina's mentioned, Barbara with Mapnia Bay, Farah Griffin and Martha Jones with one of the editors of Toward an Intellectual History of Black Women. We even considered entitling this volume Towards an Intellectual History of Women's International Thought, but Barbara's discouraged that, and so we immediately dropped the idea. Women's intellectual production clearly lends itself to anthology form, and the anthology form is most useful when you're doing, I think, a recovery project and trying to create resources for curricular reform, for political mobilization, as well as scholarly intervention. Mm-hmm. So this is an important feminist genre, and as Katrina's mentioned, we've worked through this genre in the project. We're just finalizing the remaining permissions on the anthology that will come out later this year, which we co-edited with Kim Hutchings and Sarah Dunstan. It's 748 pages long. It will be the largest anthology of international thought in print. What anthology allows you to do is include, you know, showcase not just books and journal articles, but also newspaper articles, book reviews. We've included radio addresses, poetry, internal memoranda, teaching materials. Again, showcasing sort of the variety of women's intellectual production in this field, just really proving beyond doubt their not just their presence and the number of these figures, but also the centrality of their work in this emerging early field of international relations. So the anthologies, it is primarily the teaching companion to the edited volume. It is for teaching use, but actually we think that it will have that it will be an important contribution to sort of scholarship in the field as well.
Yes, and maybe just to add to that, if I may, one of the things that struck us as we were working on the anthology was that initially, obviously, when you start a project, there is always some skepticism, and there was some skepticism whether we would find enough women who wrote on international relations as we define them. But we ended up having too many that we could not include everybody that would have been interesting and we would have liked to include. So it is an initial attempt. Obviously, an anthology is in some way field mapping, but I would assume that anybody who has ever completed one would feel that it's not quite enough, and there's much more to do. So I think it's a starting point, maybe one point in the conversation, and we hope, obviously, that this will be generative of more research. And as somebody who teaches a lot, I personally really hope that this will influence teaching on modules or courses, not just in intellectual history, but also in IR, and to be a really, really useful cross-disciplinary teaching resource.
Well, I, for one, am certainly looking out for this anthology. But before we speak more about that, let's turn now more directly to the book and its chapters. There are 15 chapters in a book organized around three broad sections: canonical thinkers, outsiders, and thinking in or around the academy. The book thus addresses a broad range of thematic concerns and geographic spaces, while opening up new possibilities for the study of international thought. The volume does not seek to merely add women to the existing record of international thought, but rather to unsettle its received historical and theoretical categories. In that respect, your analysis draws importantly on feminist theoretical literature in historicizing the category of women, rather than assuming it to be ontologically or transhistorically stable. You write that, quote, "the operations of gender, the discursive organization and interpretation of sexual difference shape the conditions, content, and reception of international thought." Could you perhaps elaborate on the category of historical women, and what is the consequent methodological relationship that emerges between gender and intellectual history on one hand, and the experiences and ideas of historical women on the other?
This is a fundamental question, and thank you for raising it. For us to speak of historical women, so historical doesn't just mean for us women working before the late 20th century, but also, well, we do not commit, it doesn't commit us to gender essentialism or assume a correspondence between biology and gender. So the historical is also a sort of constructivist intellectual move. So the claim is that the historical opera, why we focus on women or historical women, is the claim that the historical operations of the dominant sex gender binary influence the production and reception of international thought. So in the survey of 60 histories that I mentioned earlier, historical women are identified through gendered names and pronouns. This is not taken to be synonymous with the self-identity of those named or the gender of those names. So the project acknowledges the many ways that historical actors have professed indifference to, rejected, deployed, contested prevailing sex gender norms. So in the anthology, for example, we include two figures who were gender nonconforming, Simone Weil and Pauline Murray. We include them. The way we include them is recognition of how they were read, of the effects of the operation of assumptions around their gender identity on the content and reception of their intellectual work. We're not seeking to impose on them an identity that they rejected. That would be my answer to that. So the last part of your question.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we live in the middle of a gender revolution, I think you could say, and these meanings are contested. I think historically, or coming from intellectual history, Quentin Skinner once suggested a test that can be applied to a modern interpretation. Could the author be brought to accept that this was the meaning of her text? And we might also apply this test to such categories. And obviously, there are. We cannot assume the sort of transhistorical stability of some of these categories, but we needed a kind of a working base to proceed in our research, and I think we found a good solution there.
Thank you for that. Really, I mean, I think this book really shows us clearly the kind of gendered, sexualized dimensions of international thought and the field of international relations. And I want to further talk about your definition of thought and thinking. So this volume inaugurates an important rethinking of the categories of thought and thinking and offers a capacious definition of what kind of thinking constitutes international thought. So on the one hand, it recognizes the mutually imbricated nature of thought with positionality and subjectivity. On the other hand, it also recognizes the interrelated domains of policy formulation, practice, activism, and definitely the apparatuses and systems of intellectual production. Why did you see it necessary to rethink the conditions of possibilities for intellectual production? And what might this capacious view of thought enable us to see that would otherwise be occluded or excluded in conventional intellectual historical accounts? Could you elaborate on how centering and analyzing women's intellectual thought can reveal the gendered, racialized, sexualized foundations of IR or international thought and reorient the field?
So here we're making a point that's very basic and common to women's intellectual history and feminist political theory. Gendered, racialized, sexual, national class hierarchies are fundamental enabling and disabling conditions for not just the production, but also the reception and of all knowledge about international relations. So, I mean, if as IR has done, we focus on a narrow swathe of male-dominated locations and occupations and genres and positions, then we have a really impoverished understanding of the intellectual history of the field. So we're not really making an original argument here. But we're doing a recovery and analysis when in a kind of new context. But in the context of cross-disciplinary work in international intellectual history, we do show that a narrow view of thought and thinking means that has resulted in the fact that, you know, that the mediocre work of white men is celebrated, it is canonized, and the exceptional work of those gendered female, racialized as non-white, can be ignored, appropriated, and or maligned. Now, we also think it's important that we don't just that the figures that we are recovering are not only exceptional figures, that we want to include mediocre work as part of the intellectual and disciplinary history of international relations, as of, you know, the mediocre work of, you know, white, what we might describe as white women's IR in the British context is also part of it, isn't part of the interesting history of that field.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, there were many differences between the different thinkers that are featured in the volume, and some of the important international women's organizations that were key locations for international thought have already been well recovered, and here I'd just like to mention the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. So these were quite hospitable places for some women, because WILF, as it was called, it had an expansive educational operation, produced reports, held conferences, etc., etc. But other thinkers in this volume had faced many more difficulties and couldn't really be considered intellectuals, as has just been mentioned. I mean, these were thinkers who were eccentric, maybe mediocre, sometimes, you know, difficult to take seriously on their own terms. But all the same, we thought it was very important to include them, because a sort of generous reading of some of these figures produced very interesting insights into, for example, the case of Elizabeth Lippincott McQueen. She provided us with an interesting insight into the connection between technology and technological and racial utopias in the interwar period, which sort of fitted in with an Anglo-American millenarianism, a particular form of spirituality that sort of to us showed a really interesting way in which women and gender were also really important for introducing a certain vision of aviation-led globalism in the United States. So even thinkers that we might usually exclude from the history of the discipline can actually tell us important insights about intellectual life more broadly, and also about international theorizing.
Thank you so much for that, because I think that that brings us to a really important point when we think about the lives and itineraries of these ideological concept formations, especially because this book focuses on the late 19th to mid 20th century moment, which witnessed the emergence of international relations as a distinct sphere, new international organizations and conceptualizations of international law. This was also a moment witnessing the development of a range of political and intellectual projects. So you have imperialism and anti-imperialism, liberalism, socialism, Marxism, conservatism and fascism, nationalism and internationalism, etc. So here my question then would be, how does this volume contribute to and challenge understandings of these ideological formations? And what does a sustained engagement of gender enable in terms of apprehending the conditions of possibility, undergirding the growth of international thought as an intellectual tradition? And perhaps as a question that's somewhat related to that, how do you examine the contradictions that are imminent to these women's global engagements?
This is another great question.
It's a very long question. It's hard to do it justice.
I mean, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that in the 1920s and 30s, international thought was a quite feminized domain, partly due, it was a space that women could enter into. It was sort of a new terrain. Some of the earliest teaching and research centers where, women were present, they made their way in as international thinkers in the academy, partly due to the novelty of the subject matter. It's fluid intellectual boundaries. There was nobody had been disciplined into it yet. It was an emerging field. And it co-emerged with the expansion of women's higher education. And this is a really important point that the doctoral researcher on the project, Joanna Wood, is telling a really brilliant story in the context of the US. So all this meant that large numbers of women scholars and teachers were really formative in the development of the study of international relations in terms of the movement concepts that you identify. I mean, women engaged with and contributed to all of them, and this is clear not just from the edited volume, but then the anthology, and they sometimes defined them. So, Rosa Luxemburg, she was at the forefront of thinking on the intersection between capitalism and international relations in the 1910s. Ellen Churchill Semple, one of the most influential proponents of geopolitical thought in the United States in the 10s, 20s, 30s. One of the earliest theorizations of Black internationalism, of course, was Jean Nadal's Internationalism Noir, published in 1928, which we accept in the anthology. Famously, increasingly famously, the use of the English term international thought itself is traced to Florence Melian Stuhl's The Growth of International Thought, published in 1929. And, despite this heritage, the first close reading of this work appears with Glenda Sluger's essay in the edited volume. The list could go on.
Yes, you in your list of movements, you have left out feminism and the women's movement and also the movement for suffrage, which is also the backdrop to some of this work. We didn't address it specifically in the volume. It features a bit more heavily in the anthology, but obviously the question of political selfhood, of legal selfhood for women, is inextricably linked with some of these developments in the era, especially of World War One and the sort of turn of the 20th century more generally. There's a wave of suffrage activism in this period, and it is often sort of, it intersects with movements for anti-colonial nationalism, for example, or liberal internationalism and world order thinking. Some of these movements that you have mentioned, we have not covered in as much detail. So I would sort of highlight conservatism and fascism. There is certainly more work to be to be done, especially sort of given resurgent interest in what is sometimes termed fascist internationalism. And here again, I'd like to point to a very important edited collection on internationalism by Glenda Sluger and Patricia Clavin. But feminism is important for some of the thinkers in the volume to return more centrally to the book. This is apparent, for example, in a chapter by Lucian Ashworth, who looks at thinkers who take a feminist, even maternalist position, but come to very different conclusions. And maternalism is obviously also important in the thinking of Eslanda Robeson, possibly also in the thinking of Amy Ashworth Garvey, but maybe I'll leave that for later on in the discussion.
Thank you, and we are definitely going to talk about like specific chapters. So in the first section, the first four essays of the volume revisits the intellectual over of four canonical thinkers in 20th century international thought: Anna Julia Cooper, Eslanda Robeson, Rosa Luxemburg, and Simone Weil. Can you tell us briefly how these essays provide new frames for thinking about historical recovery as an epistemological project? What are the historical and contemporary stakes of revisiting this archive of thought? How might these chapters offer a new frame for thinking about international politics within the context of race, racialization, empire, and diaspora, and review the relationship between one's positionality and knowledge production?
I think one way of thinking about recovery projects as an epistemological project and as a way of sort of also reorienting the field is by looking at how and why women and canonical thinkers were excluded in the first place, and some of the limits of recovery. So Vivian May, in her essay on Anna Julia Cooper, addresses this question directly. It's not difficult to see that Cooper's, you know, why Cooper would be radically excluded from IR, because she violated the gendered, civilizational, and Eurocentric assumptions of the field. But Vivian May also explicitly reflects on the politics and practices of recovery in the sort of terms that you describe. In terms of this sort of stakes in revisiting this archive of thought, in terms of transforming our work and knowledge practices, Vivian May points out that despite 40 years using her, the chapter open in front of me, she says, despite over 40 years of careful recovery efforts and thoughtful interdisciplinary scholarship on Cooper, her work continues to remain overlooked in fields where her contributions could be taken up. If the field's normative genealogies, methodologies, and histories have been marked by dominant race, gender, and class assumptions about what counts as international thought, then these problems cannot really be remedied by folding excluded thinkers' concepts and issues into extant frames and histories. Rather, such change requires reflexivity, confronting how power imbues interpretive norms and ensures archival absences and transforming our work and knowledge practices, end quote. Kim Hutchings and I tried to do this and show how and why figures were excluded in the first place in a new article in American Political Science Review, where we pick up on Cooper, but also canonical thinkers Ellen Churchill Semple and Bertha von Suttner. And, Semple was marginalized in histories of international thought through the denial of independent meaning to her ideas, placing them as immediately superseded by her own students. Suttner, she's construed as not serious, unsystematic, comical, sentimental, because she wrote in explicitly feminized, from an explicitly feminized standpoint and in the first person in novels. And, Cooper, again, could never have been included among IR's intellectual greats, even much more than Semple and Suttner, who met every other criteria of being included in the canon. Cooper offers such a profound challenge to dominant accounts of international relations. So to in terms of the epistemological project of recovery, her inclusion and the inclusion of other Black internationalist thinkers necessarily reorients the field. That's a little bit more hopeful, I think, than a conclusion than Vivian May's, after working on Cooper for a long time. I think she's probably more qualified to make this position, but I'm still a bit more hopeful.
I mean, I don't really have much to add to this, but I do believe that this section on the canon, or this part of the book on the canon, is hugely important. If it's okay, I can say a bit more about the next part of the book, about the outsiders. You provided some questions and listed some of these figures: Elizabeth Wiskman, Elizabeth Lippincott McQueen, Amy Ashford Garvey, Mitty Maud, Lena Gordon, and asked us to reflect on genres, boundaries, and audiences in regard to these thinkers. To these in the book, we also add the women of the Women's International League and Freedom. Now, maybe with some hindsight, I think they are a bit apart, because WILF, as the organization was known, was actually fairly established and had a sort of quasi-official status in Geneva with the League of Nations at some point in the interwar years. But the sort of outsiders that we included in the book, or the essays on those, are really quite different thinkers in terms of background, the opportunities they had, the kinds of discrimination they faced, and also the way in which they were treated by the powers that be. So the two African-American women in the section, Amy Ashford Garvey and Mitty Maud Lena Gordon, they faced considerable racism. This contrasts to somebody like Elizabeth Wiskman, who was a commercially quite successful author. She wrote hugely successful books on contemporary affairs, on international politics, and she was very well respected, even though she really struggled financially in terms of finding a university post that was well paid. Then obviously we had the politics here. So Mitty Maud Lena Gordon was involved in clandestine networks that were regarded by the American state as subversive, and she actually ended up facing prosecution. So this outsiders part of the book is a bit difficult in terms of finding a common denominator. But one of the things that I think this section shows us are the often very precarious material conditions in which these women thinkers worked. So whether that applies to Elizabeth Wiskman, who had problems securing a stable income despite being very prolific, or to Gordon, who wrote also quite prolifically, but whose writings had to be read out. They had to be transmitted orally because there was just not enough money to reproduce them. Or indeed to Elizabeth Lippincott McQueen, who had this peripatetic existence as a very charismatic figure who depended on wealthy patrons, but who was nonetheless on the margins of some of the more established international relations thinking, or at least the international relations education circuit. I mean, the issue of publicness and speaking to different publics, and indeed counter publics, is also an undercurrent in this section of the book. So I think that might be something useful to reflect on in terms of audiences and of boundaries. What sort of publics, what audiences do these thinkers address? And what is their relation to the powers that be? I mean, the other aspect that I would like to highlight in the section is that some of these thinkers thought against the grain. They maybe embraced positions that we might now find worthy of critique, or that we might not agree with, whether that's Amy Ashford Garvey's respectability politics that were nonetheless quite subversive of Black patriarchy, as Robbie Shillian outlines in his chapter, or Gordon's championing of the Japanese empire, or McQueen's white racial Anglo-American utopia. Some of these positions are difficult, are complex. If I had to think of one thinker that was the most respectable, that was probably Elizabeth Wiskman. But even she faced problems in the 1930s. She was working as a reporter in Berlin, and she was arrested by the Gestapo and had to leave the country. So their outsider status is something that does run through the section, even though we have thinkers with very different intellectual and political commitments and also opportunities.
Thank you so much for that. And I think that leads us very nicely to the final section of the volume, which turns to women theories located within the academy. And how might this allow us to rethink the emergence and differentiation of disciplinary knowledge, methodology, and protocol? And what do these thinkers offer us by way of insights into the historicity of knowledge production itself?
This is another massive and important question. Not only because I'm still slightly overwhelmed by that question, because it's the subject of my work, my main work in progress right now. My next book is my single authored book. Will attempt a revisionist history of practices, genres, audiences of international relations expertise in early to long mid 20th century Britain. Taking up figures largely unknown to shed light on the field's racial and gendered history. So in the British context, it's largely, but not entirely, one of white women's IR, practiced with varying degrees of attention to and complicity in racial hierarchies, unsurprisingly. Like the other figures that we've encountered, these figures adopt a range of responses to gendered power and their own gendered identities. Kinship, class, and intimate relations obviously mattered. These were privileged daughters of diplomats, wives and mistresses of canonical men, unmarried women, queer. These are sort of themes, the themes that come out of the project as a whole, of professional contexts, of fields and disciplines. You know, what were the fields and disciplines where international relations was practiced, and how did that change? How a race and nation configured in the late empire, and the emergence of a sort of post-imperial Britain and a new international relations, and professional contexts as well. Some of these themes are picked up in or are elaborated on in the section in the edited volume on thinking in or around the academy. But my main session at the moment is thinking about this in the British context.
Yes, I mean, if I could maybe add a little bit on the American context, and we also have one thinker in the book, Christina Marek, who was based in Geneva. She was of Polish origin, but she ended up as a professor in Geneva, but at an institution that had been founded with American philanthropic money. But the one Black thinker we have in our section on the academy is Morris Tate, who became a professor at Howard University. And again, this is a huge work in progress by Barbara Savage right now, who's writing her biography. But Morris Tate was highly unusual, securing a professorship as a Black woman in the US Academy was highly unusual. And it is no accident that she is the only woman of color in this particular section, that was the nature of academic international thought in Britain, in the United States, in this period.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Patricia and Katerina. We have taken up a lot of your time, and it's definitely been a real pleasure to discuss your work with you. And we certainly can't wait for the new volume, Women's International Thought Towards a New Canon, which will be published soon, and we can actually pre-order that volume now. This is your host, Stephen Liu, and thanks to our listeners for tuning in to today's episode, in which we explored Women's International Thought, A New History, published in 2021 by Cambridge University Press. I'm your host, Zifeng Liu.
And I'm your co-host, Calvin Ng. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in Intellectual History. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.